Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, your host today, and I'm very fortunate to be joined by Robert Polin. He is Distinguished University Professor of Economics and Co-Director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's here today because he's partnered with famed public intellectual Noam Chomsky on an inspiring new book called Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet. They wrote it in conversation with C.J. Polykernow, and it comes out today from Verso Books. Robert Polin, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Brian.
Now, when we were working to find a time for this interview and Dr. Chomsky realized his schedule was unforgiving, he told us to go on without him because, in his words, it's too important to wait. Now, he wasn't commenting on the importance of this program, of course, but on the state of the world. And, you know, I think many of us worried back in the spring that COVID might sort of bury the climate crisis in the public consciousness. But now, come fall, that concern feels kind of a bit quaint. You know, we've kind of grown accustomed to the overlap of the fire season in the West and the hurricane season in the Gulf, kind of focusing media attention on the climate for a few weeks every year. And this year, we're adding to it, you know, like the very bad news out of Antarctica and President Trump's staggering denialism, and Scientific America making its first presidential endorsement in 175-year history, you know, and all of that happened literally yesterday. So I wonder, before we dive into the book, would you like to offer any reactions to the climate news that's, you know, grabbed headlines in just the first half of this month alone?
Well, that was a great summary. And the news is just absolutely devastating. I mean, it's not surprising in the sense that this is the kind of thing that climate scientists have been telling us, and they're saying that we're operating within a nonlinear framework. There's uncertainty. Things could be more intense and could start changing more aggressively than we anticipate. And I've heard that. And of course, I'm not a climate scientist, so that's really not my domain. I hear those things, but then you don't really, I mean, at least I don't. I don't imagine it's all going to happen all that quickly, and then it does. So it only reinforces, as Noam said to you, the urgency of doing and understanding how absolutely critical it is, all of these things. Of course, you can't pin 100% of all of these phenomena on climate change, but you can pin a very high percentage. Well, the Antarctic stuff, you can pin 100%. But in any case, what we are seeing is really the acceleration of the nature of the emergency. It's not an exaggeration to say that we are facing a climate emergency and that action has to be taken, a dramatic action has to be taken. And actually, we do not spend a lot of time in the book on issues around adaptation. You know, the fact that there are certain things we just can't control right now. So how do we adapt people and make it at least livable while we come up with a long-term solution? We spend a little time on that, but I probably should have spent more time on that.
Now, the the Green New Deal as sort of a slogan or a phrase has been kicking around for maybe a decade or so. And it's, of course, it's grabbed headlines in the last couple of years since the Ocasio-Cortez and Markey resolution in 2018. But, you know, you've been doing work that fits the mold of a Green New Deal for much longer than that. And I wondered if you could help listeners just sketch out a path of that your work's taken to get you to how you're thinking today about the climate crisis. And I also wonder, you know, you do a little bit in the book explaining how orthodox economics has related to the climate crisis and in kind of halting ways over the years, and how your approach is sort of relates to mainstream economic thought.
Yeah. Well, my background is, I guess, in terms of my subfield, we'd say macroeconomics. So it's just, you know, the economy as a whole. And then I also got involved in issues around labor, issues around finance, and all of that's wrapped in a big picture, which I freely admit I come at it from a left progressive perspective, which is not the mainstream in economics. But the truth is, and I'm making a lot of confessions here, the truth is I was interested in these issues, but I had done exactly zero work on it up until I would say 2007 or thereabouts. And the reason I talked about doing it and I never did, because I had all these other projects and it wasn't my specialty. But I finished a book in 2004 called Contours of Dissent, which was about the macroeconomics in the US and the globe. And I actually put in chapter one that I realize that I have a big deficiency in the book because I'm not talking about climate change. I'm talking about issues around economic growth, job creation, so forth, and distribution, who gets what, but I'm not putting it in the context of the climate crisis. And so at that point, I put that in the literally in chapter one that I'm going to start integrating that into my work. And even having written that and published it, it still took me about 2 years to get up to speed. So, in a sense, I'm like a, you know, eager amateur. I'm not really an environmental economist in the traditional sense. So that does give me some advantages because my view is that, yes, the orthodox economics has dealt with this in a really insufficient way. The best example for that is the awarding of the Nobel Prize in Economics 2 years ago to William Nordhaus, who is almost certainly the most prominent economist working on these issues of climate change. And his perspective is really atrocious. I mean, again, this is not an understatement. I mean, in his Nobel lecture in December 2018, he makes the point, it's right in the lecture, that the optimal result is that we stabilize the global mean temperature, the average temperature at 4 degrees Celsius above prehistoric levels, whereas the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the experts, climate scientists, saying we have to stabilize at 1.5 degrees or we're facing, you know, dire consequences. And we see the dire consequences. But here you have William Nordhaus, the most prominent economist on these issues in the world, the Nobel laureate of 2018, who gives his Nobel lecture only 2 months after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is coming out with a report that insists that we have to stabilize at 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. He's saying 4 is fine, 4 degrees is fine. So that's, you know, that gives you where I'm coming at that is dramatically different.
Against the tide. You also, you worked in the Obama White House on the stimulus in 2009 on green jobs, right?
Yeah. So that's really kind of, I got lucky as academics go, because the very first paper I did on this was commissioned by the Center for American Progress, which is this kind of center-left think tank in Washington. And I was doing a big study, but they said, we'll peel off a little part of it and just focus on this issue of jobs because we're looking at a recession. This was 2008. And what can we say as in terms of the green investments as a counterforce to the upcoming recession. So I did this paper with some coworkers here at UMass, and I thought it was okay, but I thought it was just another paper that I'd written. But the Center for American Progress, because they're very wired in Washington, and we're facing a recession, they got this paper out, and it became, according to the New York Times at that time, they said it was the blueprint for the green parts of the stimulus. And so that's that became an important document to really think about how to do the green stimulus. And then I got hired as a consultant in the energy department once the overall stimulus program passed February 2009. So I really was involved in a very interesting way for a couple of years in pushing this agenda, because the Obama stimulus, it was called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. About 12% of all the spending that was allocated, $90 billion out of about $800 billion, was for green investments. So this was, as far as I know, the most ambitious green investment program in the history of the world. It didn't turn out as well as I would have liked, but there was some significant forward progress.
And I mean, I read Adam Tooze's book this summer about the history of the last 10 years of economic history. And in his retelling, you know, he says that Obama wanted more green jobs money for that. But, you know, the politics didn't work out. Or in you reflect in this book that just the logistics of having projects that were ready to go to get the money out was hard. But in the long run, the stimulus seems to have paid for itself. Is there a lesson there?
The stimulus, I mean, generally speaking, beyond just the green parts, the stimulus was mildly effective. It prevented a Great Depression, which we would have had in comparable to the 1930s. And the green parts of the stimulus were also, on balance, effective. And I'm happy about that and proud that I made a tiny contribution. It was not nearly as good as it might have been. And we can say that that was due to politics, certainly by the in November 2010, when the Republicans took back the House of Representatives, that was a real barrier to any forward progress. But there were also self-inflicted problems. Number one, as I think you just alluded to, what we did not do, and I'll say what I did not do, because it was my paper that they said was the blueprint, we didn't pay enough attention to how to get things out quickly, like very quickly. You know, the term of the time was shovel-ready projects. When can you start digging? You know, get the shovels all ready to go. And we really didn't focus on that. And that really, more generally, in macroeconomic policy design, that is not a very well thought out problem, although it's extremely practical. Like you have a depression coming. Okay, we want to do some great things and we want to invest in important things that will have long lasting value. But are we going to get money out in 2 months or 2 years? Mm-hmm. There was not really adequate understanding of that. And again, I fault myself as much as anybody else. So that was part of it. The other part where I thought the design in retrospect was not correct was it put too much weight on private sector tax incentives. I'm in favor of private sector tax incentives, but when you're facing a recession, especially, and you're talking about doing new innovative things, which building a green economy is and remains new and innovative, you really can't expect the take-up rate to be as rapid as necessary. So what should have happened was a much larger share of the overall $90 billion being spent by the government, the public sector, as opposed to waiting for private investors to come along.
Now, in some circles, or maybe we can call them echo chambers, the Green New Deal has become so popular a concept that it sort of has started to seem like the obvious and only way that we'd respond to the climate crisis. And I'm all for that. But of course, that's not true. And, you know, and just a few years ago, there was a less kind of socially justice inflected version of climate response. And so I think it's probably worth remembering that there are other options and probably less desirable, and remembering what that means. And so I wondered, you know, what would an effective but unjust climate policy look like? You know, we often hear about the catastrophic consequences of doing nothing in the face of climate change, but what would the consequences be of doing something, maybe even something that gets us to net zero emissions by 2050 even, but doing it badly?
Yeah. Well, we have an obvious case in point here, which was what happened last year in France, where a President Macron tried to impose a carbon tax, and he faced an uprising, the so-called Yellow Vest movement, where people were saying, yes, of course we care about the climate, the future of the planet, but we're talking about the present in my household this week. I don't have enough money for groceries. And so by imposing the carbon tax, you're making me pay more for a necessity, energy, which means I'll have even less money for everything else. And so that's what caused the Yellow Vest uprising, which then Macron had to back off on the carbon tax idea. And, you know, it wasted probably a year, 2 years, 3 years where serious action could have been taken. Now, you can say a carbon tax, meaning basically we're going to raise the price of your purchases of oil, coal, and natural gas, which are, you know, largely necessities. That could work. You just keep jacking up the price. And eventually people aren't going to pay $35 for a gallon of gasoline. Whatever, you know, you can say whatever it takes. And that's one of the features of, you know, a more orthodox approach, such as advocated by people like William Nordhaus, which is just use the price mechanism, because markets are the most efficient ways to do things anyway. So jack up the price enough, and then everything else will adjust. So, but that is unjust, because what you're then doing is imposing massive increases in the cost of living on vulnerable people, because energy being a necessity, that means that people who don't have a lot of discretionary income or have less overall income are going to then spend a higher proportion of their overall consumption basket on energy, which means they're going to have less for everything else. The way to do it alternatively would be to, if you're going to use a carbon tax, then you get the revenues and you rebate the revenues back to at least the, you know, the lower half of the income distribution. But Macron didn't do that. And so the approach, carbon taxes keep losing, and Washington State, it lost because, you know, if you just say, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have a tax, and we need it for the climate to reverse the damage we're doing, and not do anything else, it is a bad, bad policy intervention.
The book's, you know, of course, mostly about the present and the future, but there are several moments where you sort of mine history to find, you know, a usable past, as they say. And now there's nothing in here about the actual New Deal, but there is a lot, or a fair amount, about mobilization for World War II and federal R&D investment in the immediate post-war period. And why is that an instructive moment in history to look to?
You know, when you said, and you wrote to me, you said there's nothing about the New Deal, it actually hadn't occurred to me that that was another oversight. And maybe if we do a second edition, I will put something in about the actual 1930s New Deal, because there was innovation there, and primarily around the Civilian Conservation Corps, mm-hmm. which was an effort to invest in environmental protection and do so in a way that creates jobs. So that's totally in the spirit of what I see to be the Green New Deal at present. The problem then, and maybe that's why we didn't, I didn't do it deliberately, but it wasn't at a large enough scale. The concept was very good. The scale of the investment on the Civilian Conservation Corps and other environmental initiatives in pre-World War II under Roosevelt was not large enough, which is why we went through the whole 1930s and we actually had not gotten out of the Great Depression. It was World War II that created this massive public intervention to mobilize for war. And so the lesson there is, well, you know, when you really have to do it, the U.S. proved that we could do it. At that time, we mobilized roughly 25% of the economy on the war effort. And the government said, well, whatever it takes, we're not worried about piling up debt. We've got to win the war. And there was also huge innovations taking place, innovations in aviation, which was absolutely critical. And then, of course, we know about the development of the nuclear bomb. So all of those things were within the context of World War II, led by public investment and public policy. So I think the lesson there is that mobilize the public sector, the federal government in particular, get the financing to the scale necessary, and move forward on that foundation. There's, of course, still a role for the private sector, but you need much stronger leadership in the public sector. The other thing about why I like the term the Green New Deal, it does evoke, obviously, Roosevelt in the 1930s, and the idea being that the Green New Deal, or the New Deal, connotes something about advancing equality within existing institutions. We're not, it's important to think about what we would like, 75 years hence in terms of a fair society and economy, but how do we get from A to B? And to get from A to B right now means we have to avoid a climate catastrophe. So we have to take massive action now within our existing institutions and make our initiatives workable, viable.
Yeah, I'm no expert in the wartime economy, but every time I read these statistics, it's just mind blowing. I think something like the airline industry was smaller than the candy industry in America before World War II, and then after World War II, of course, it's a leading sector of the economy, and so miracles can happen. But also, it was not taken over by public industry, but it was still remained private the whole time. That was important to Roosevelt. But so it's fascinating. Well, we get to the heart of your book, and that's of course your framework for, how we're going to do this, and from an economics perspective, and the industrial and financial policies needed to get the world to net zero emissions by 2050 in a just and equitable way. Yeah. And in some of the broadest strokes, the content of your proposals looks familiar. You put a lot of emphasis on transitions to wind and solar, reversing deforestation, adding afforestation as the most effective way to, if we're going to talk about carbon capture, we should do it with trees first. And organic agriculture as being really important. But the means by which we get to these initiatives and the way we support them at the scale necessary, you take us into the weeds of economics, a place where plenty of ardent environmentalists aren't terribly comfortable, myself included. And I never took an economics class in college, and I've been constantly regretting, especially from the macro stuff. I'm constantly trying to teach myself macro on like Wikipedia and Investopedia, and it's going slow. But I have a captive audience tonight, so I wonder if you could give me a crash course in a couple of the few mechanisms here that you place a lot of importance on.
Sure.
Some of them sound kind of arcane, but they look really powerful. One here is this concept of a feed-in tariff. Mm. What's a feed-in tariff, Bob?
Yeah, so it's a fancy term, and if I didn't explain it in the book, that's another deficiency of the book.
I'm pretending to not know. I'm hoping you can teach us all.
Okay. So basically all it is that the government sets the price for wind power, solar power, so that private investors know what they you strip away the uncertainty that is generally associated with a private investment. I mean, if I were to invest in a candy store, I don't know who's going to come into the store. I don't know at what price they're going to be willing to buy my goods. So that's part of how capitalism operates. A feed-in tariff just says, here's the price. You have a 30-year contract, and the government is going to set the price for solar electricity. And this is going to be a price at which we think you can keep your operations going and make some profit, but it's not going to be excessive profits because we're stripping away the some of the risk that you're facing. So that's what a feed-in tariff is. That's all it is. Another fancy way to say it, it's a forward contract, meaning that we are setting the price for electricity generated by, say, solar power. Not today, but, you know, we're setting it today for 5 years from now, 8 years from now, and then it makes it easier for people to invest.
And governments have put these in place in places around the world?
Oh, yeah. It started in the United States. The idea of a feed-in tariff started. A lot of the innovations actually came out of California, and Jerry Brown, when he was first governor and actively and committed around environmental issues in the 1970s. And, you know, California is almost, I mean, it's one of the biggest economies in and of itself. So when you have a governor that is supportive of these things in California, you've got a lot of room to experiment. And, you know, for all of criticisms we may have of Jerry Brown, he definitely was trying to introduce new ideas in order to advance an environmental agenda. So that's what a feed-in tariff is. And it's really been most effective in Europe. It has been instrumental in the developments in Europe, where, you know, they operate at about roughly 40% lower emissions per capita than we do in the United States. That's pretty good.
You also do, you know, it might surprise people, as you say, you're a left progressive economist. You do have an important role for carbon caps and carbon taxes in here. So how do we do that justly?
So a carbon cap would basically just say, this is how much by regulation, we allow utilities to burn fossil fuels and no more. So another technical term for that is renewable portfolio standards. And a lot of states now have them, that they say by, you know, 2040, that the electricity has to be 75, 80%, 90, even 100% renewable. So, for example, Colorado, one state where I've done a bit of work, has a renewable portfolio that says that, I think it's by 2040, that we have to be at 100% renewable electricity. So that is a great regulatory tool. The only problem is you have to make sure you enforce it, because I did some work also in New York State, and they had renewable portfolio standard for 2015. Well, they didn't hit the standard. There was a lot of fanfare when they introduced it. They didn't hit it. And then there was absolutely no publicity about this at all. Then they just set a new standard for 2030. And so it's great to have these standards, but they're regulations and they have to bite. So I would say, yeah, let's say you have to reduce your use of fossil fuel energy by, let's say, 5% per year. And if you don't hit the standard, the CEO of the utility goes to prison.
Yeah.
I mean, really. You know,
no, it jumped out at me when you wrote that on the page. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Something like that. That'll get their attention. As it happens, if you look at the evidence from the Trump-owned energy department, on average, solar power, wind power, geothermal power, hydro are at parity or cheaper than fossil fuel energy and nuclear. So why shouldn't these utilities be investing in renewable energy? They need to. So that's a carbon cap. And then a carbon tax is like what I was describing, what they did in France, where you just say, a gallon of gasoline has so much carbon in it. So for whatever percentage of carbon, you have to pay an extra 25 cents. And that starts to add up, or, you know, depending on where you set the tax rate. The massive problem with the carbon tax is the problem that we talked about with respect to France and the Yellow Vest movement. It's extremely unfair. It's unequal if you don't rebate the money back to people. Because it way disproportionately impacts low-income people that have to spend a lot of their overall income on energy. So, but it's easy to get around that. It's just say, okay, we raise $1 billion through the carbon tax. We give $750 billion right back to the, let's say, the lower two-thirds of the income distribution. We save a third for investing in green energy. And that way you are discouraging everybody from buying fossil fuel energy, but you also are giving them money to keep living and then presumably to help them start purchasing renewable energy.
And you also, you show how that could be kind of a I won't say simple, but an at least an elegant macroeconomic way to redistribute wealth from countries that have, you know, disproportionately benefited from burning fossil fuels to those that haven't. So, and you say, like, if everyone gets $60 the world round, that's going to go a lot farther in Kenya than it will in the U.S.
Yes. So that would be, a global carbon tax, which is a good idea. And right, it's very equal shares. You raise, I forget the number I had in the book, but I did some fairly careful calculations. And then I say, okay, whatever it was, $300 billion. And everybody gets an equal share. So everybody gets $60. Now, you know, somebody who's a millionaire in the United States, $60 isn't even worth picking up if you saw it lying on the street. Whereas in Kenya, it's going to be, 5% of your income for a year. That's not bad. So that's a very simple, it can be an effective tool for discouraging fossil fuel consumption and for promoting a more equal society.
And we got to talk about the Fed and help me out here. This is one of the things I constantly Google. But, you know, the Fed has sort of a dizzying, its political valences shift quite fast over at least my lifetime, right? That it's easy to see the Fed as a villain for the left and in the pocket of Wall Street. But there's also been moments this year where kind of the Fed felt like it was our only hope in as far as the federal, as national institution that could do anything here. And you have a role for the Fed to play. What would that be in the Green New Deal?
Well, your characterization of the Fed, I think, is fair in both things you said. I think it's fair to say that the Fed is largely a tool of Wall Street, and the Fed also has basically saved us from economic calamity over the last few months. It's done both of those things, and that's exactly why, we are facing near depression conditions. But meanwhile, the stock market has been going up. How could that possibly be? It only is because the Fed has bailed out the financial markets, and they have the means to do it. So since March, and we don't know exactly how much, but the Fed has pumped in the range of $5 trillion into stabilizing Wall Street, giving out loans to corporations. And $5 trillion is about 25% of entire U.S. GDP. And they came up with that in the bat of an eye. Now, some of it will get paid back, some of it won't. But if we think about that magnitude, and if we think about the levels of spending that I'm suggesting, and other people have come up with similar numbers, something like 2-3% of GDP to advance a green agenda effectively. And the Fed just pumped in 25% in a matter of 4 months. That, in other words, the Fed has the means to completely finance the Green New Deal without anybody barely noticing it. Maybe there's arguments as to why it shouldn't be done that way in entirety. And I would agree with that. But they certainly have the means to finance a very large proportion of a Green New Deal and get the thing moving. Once the momentum is going, the Green New Deal will be self-financing. In other words, people will see savings in their pockets. I see savings. I have solar panels. I don't pay any electricity bill anymore. I had to have the money for the upfront investment to buy the solar panels and to get them installed. I was able to do that in large part because you get a big tax benefit still under Trump. You still get it. I don't know how much longer if he's reelected, but that's the critical thing. And the Fed could play a central role here. And to the argument that this isn't the Fed's job, the new president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, when she first came into office in December, she said, the number one thing I'm going to focus on is climate change. People said, well, wait a minute, you're a central banker. What does that have to do with climate change? Well, that has to do with saving the planet from destruction.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The U.S. Fed has a dual mandate, right? To keep, is it to keep interest rates or keep inflation in check and to also support full employment?
Exactly.
Right? And the ECB doesn't have that. Lagarde doesn't have that same mandate. Full employment is, I think, is a phrase that it was a household word for term for most of the 20th century and then wasn't when I was growing up. What is full employment? Does it exist? Will it ever come back? And how would it fit in the Green New Deal?
Well, yes, I think full employment is a kind of slippery term. I myself wrote a little book called Back to Full Employment. But, you know, on page one, I just said, well, I think we better define what we mean when we start talking about it. I think the simplest way to think about full employment is an abundance of decent jobs, good jobs, so that anybody that, you know, is able and willing to work could get one of them. And that would be a job that pays decently and that offers dignity and a safe workplace. So, you know, then boiling that down into, you know, details, of course, takes a while, but that's the basic idea. Now, the Green New Deal, I think, is not only fully consistent, but can be a powerful vehicle on behalf of full employment, because the Green New Deal means spending money to rebuild an entire energy infrastructure. So that means creating a lot of jobs, millions of jobs, here in the United States and everywhere. And it's a myth to think that, oh, all these jobs are, you know, just going to be for people who are like, you know, environmental crazies and you know, scientists that have the latest scheme for solar or something. It's jobs for everybody. The highest proportion of jobs in the Green New Deal are in construction. And then the second most are jobs in manufacturing. And then we have jobs for truck drivers. We have jobs for office workers. We have jobs for accountants. We have jobs for lawyers. It's across the board because it's, you know, it's building a whole new infrastructure in a relatively short time. It will require mobilizing millions of people, and that means jobs.
You do these careful calculations in the book. It's very accessible. It isn't a turnoff at all. But you come up with a tally for the global annual investment in clean energy of $2.4 trillion, you know, every year. And this question's going to sound stupid, but is that a lot of money? You know, I've been living through this period where this recurrent massive stimulus we talked about, we have negative bond yields, which is kind of mind-numbing or mind-confusing. And then also, you know, this new trend in modern monetary theory. Is $2.4 trillion a lot of money? Do we need to, how should we think about that kind of sum?
Well, that's a great question. It is not a naive question. There's different ways to approach it. One way is just to say $2.4 trillion, that's a lot of money. Yeah. And that's often used as the standard, just like, you know, you can even say, you know, $1 million. Oh my God, that's a lot of money. Okay. So I think the fair way, the more accurate and easy to understand way to scale this, to put it in perspective, is what is it as a share of overall activity in the economy? So the way we measure overall activity very imperfectly, but at least it's there is GDP, gross domestic product, which is supposed to be exactly our indicator of how much all the money that is getting spent over the course of the year to buy things, buy goods, services, everything. So the 2.4 trillion amounts to about 2.5% of global GDP in today's world. So you can still say that's a lot of money, and it is, because you still need $2.4 trillion. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, another way to say it is, well, 97.5% of all economic activity can be on everything else besides building the Green New Deal. And so we don't have to think of it at the level of mobilization as was experienced in the 1930s. I mean, maybe if we don't do anything for another 6 or 7 years, then we have to think about spending 25% of GDP and not doing anything else and putting people in jail that are going to violate the renewable portfolio standards and so forth. But right now, the magnitude of the investments necessary is, of course, massive, but it is manageable. And on top of that, it is critical, again, to say it will create jobs, it will deliver lower energy costs. And a lot of the money that I propose spending goes to improve energy efficiency, such as having LED light bulbs, such as having much more efficient cars or better public transportation. All of those things save money. It's money that people can keep in their pockets, even if it didn't do anything to help emissions. It does help a lot to reduce emissions.
You step into two internecine fights among environmentalists in this book. You step in kind of briefly and I think very sanely, but this is very third rail stuff. One is nuclear power. You know, and I had Kate Brown on the show to talk about her excellent book on Chernobyl, and suddenly just like sharing that on Twitter, suddenly I got, you know, all these responses and emails, and it's nasty out there. So what's your clear-headed vision of the role of nuclear going forward?
Well, you know, James Hansen, who's probably the most renowned climate scientist in the world and has done more, I think, to advance consciousness around the need to stabilize the climate. So I have a huge amount of respect for Hansen. I don't know him at all, but I respect him. He's a proponent of nuclear energy. So, you know, to be fair, if somebody of that level of accomplishment is a proponent of nuclear energy, then I, as a mere economist, I have to take that seriously. And I do. And Hansen's argument is, you know, yes, we are in an absolutely dire situation. So we have something that we know can work, nuclear energy. So why are we foreclosing that as an option? Okay, so that's his argument, and I respect it. Here's my counter argument, though. My counter argument is we have these technologies, solar, wind, geothermal, and efficiency, that are cheaper than nuclear. Forget about whether they're safer. They are cheaper, and they do not entail the kinds of permanent non-renewable resources, in other words, uranium, at the magnitude. And we know that there's problems of safety in terms of the spent fuel rods, in terms of the nuclear waste, in terms of the possibility of a meltdown like we had in Chernobyl and Fukushima in 2011. And there's the political risk that, using nuclear power for energy is not the same as using it for weapons, but there is obviously some clear connection there. And you're inviting all kinds of unsavory people to figure out ways to use the nuclear energy. The more that it is widespread and becomes abundant, to use it for nuclear blackmail. So if you told me that there is no other way to save the planet from climate change other than using massive amounts of nuclear energy, then okay, I would take that very seriously. But in my reading of the evidence, we have an alternative. And I'm not against closing down all nuclear power facilities now. I'm saying we have the existing ones that constitute about 5% of overall energy supply globally. Let's let them run their course, keep a very careful eye on them. But let's build out a system that whose foundation is safe, clean, and cheap. That's renewable energy and efficiency.
The other topic that arouses much passions among environmentalists is just the whether you can do growth environmentally, and folks that argue for zero growth or what you call degrowth in the book. And we see this, we saw this in 2008, and we saw this again this spring, where you have a big recession and you see also emissions fall, and people somehow, you know, there's some people that cheer that or at least say, look, and you do not cheer that.
Well, actually, I take the exact opposite lesson from the experience of the last year, because we have experienced close to a Great Depression, although hopefully it will not continue for a decade. And emissions did go down. The projection is for 2020, we're going to see emissions go down in the range of 6 or 7%. Now, that's something. But we need emissions to go down 100%, not 7%. So, that is the fallacy here. The degrowth, and I share a lot of the values with degrowth proponents, but if we're going to get to 100% zero emissions, degrowth only gets us if you don't change the energy system, you will get a reduction in emissions by exactly the amount that GDP falls. So if you have a GDP falling by 5%, emissions will fall by 5%. Now we're already in depression territory. If we want to get emissions down by 50%, then GDP has to fall by 50%. So it's not really a solution. I'm not a worshiper at the cult of economic growth. I think we have to be more specific. Building a green economy means massive growth in the clean energy system, but it also means massive contraction down to zero of the fossil fuel energy system. So yes, I'm for degrowth of fossil fuels. I'm not for degrowth of solar energy. I'm not for degrowth of efficiency. So I just don't even think the term is really all that helpful. It's a broad slogan. I was just in touch today with a PhD student in Italy who wants to interview me about this. And he's a proponent of degrowth. I said, well, look, you know my position. If you still want to talk, okay, fine. But I wish, and I told him this, we had an email exchange. I said, I wish people of this viewpoint would be a little more nuanced and not just insist on talking in broad generalities. Some things are, it's wonderful. Do we really want degrowth of the educational system? We want to have fewer teachers? I don't think so. Do we want to have less opportunity for daycare? Do we want to have less opportunity for elder care? No, we want to have those things grow. So is that degrowth or is it not degrowth? I just think we have to be much more specific.
The nuance of the book is I think, one of its great strengths. And, you know, I think people on the left often get branded dogmatic and to their own, circular firing squad and things like that. But this book is anything but dogmatic. There's a role for private enterprise. There's a role for the state. There's a role for big things and small things and different scales. And you close, Dr. Trump's going to close with a consideration of political labels and tactics. And I wonder if there's examples of activism that you see as the most promising, and if there's, mistakes that you'd like to see Green New Deal activists try to avoid.
Well, I think the most promising things, Certainly, if we want to name one person, it's Greta Thunberg, sure. This amazing young woman. I think maybe she's 17 now, or basically has captured the imagination of the entire world by her commitment to an environmental agenda just by taking a moral stance on it. But I think she's also representative of young people. Very young people, teenagers, who have taken the lead and saying, this is our world too. There's not going to be anything left for us in 40 years. I mean, you old folks will be gone. So, maybe you don't care, but we do care. So I think that has been fantastic. So the Sunrise Movement, the leader of the Sunrise Movement was actually an undergraduate student here at UMass and got involved initially in the movement here in UMass for divestment. So people like her, that's been great. The climate extinction movement has been great. Some things that have gotten less attention that I think are equally promising has been the labor movement. The U.S. Mm-hmm. mainstream labor movement has gotten involved and is increasingly committed to advancing something that they feel comfortable with as part of the Green New Deal. And their version, which is one that I strongly advocate, gives a lot of attention to the transition for people and communities that are now dependent on the fossil fuel economy. It's obvious that they're going to not be all that happy about getting their livelihoods taken away. And so we have to respect that and say, okay, therefore, we're going to make sure that part of the Green New Deal, a central part, is just transition for workers and communities so they don't have to feel the pain of this, what should be as an opportunity for all of us they should also be able to see it as an opportunity and not feel as though their lives are getting stripped away.
I hope that the weeks and months ahead will keep you busy talking about this book with Italian grad students and others. But when things calm down a little, are there current research projects you can give us a preview of?
So I'm extremely involved right now on exactly Green New Deal projects. I was commissioned in 9 states of U.S. states to write studies. I've finished two, one for California, one for Maine. I'm finishing one for Ohio right now in Pennsylvania, Appalachia, West Virginia, Kentucky. I'm doing other states. I'm also doing one for the U.S. as a whole. I'm doing one for Greece, and we'll see what happens there. I do work on other things, including Medicare for All, and maybe I'll get back to that when there's more time. But right now, my main focus is the Green New Deal. And, you know, I felt very privileged to be able to work with Noam Chomsky, who is obviously not an expert on this, but he is Noam Chomsky, one of the great thinkers historically, and a man of incredible depth, analytic depth, and moral passion. And I've learned a lot from interacting with him.
The book again is Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet. Its authors are Noam Chomsky and my guest, Robert Pollan, in conversation with CJ Polly Cronow. The book comes out today, and you can get your copy from Verso. I'm Brian Hamilton. This has been New Books in Environmental Studies. And thank you so much, Bob, for your time and for this book.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.